From the studios of Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Gemma Gaudette. It is Friday, time for our reporter roundtable. This is, of course, when we get you up to date on all of the news that made headlines this last week. There is a lot to break down today. So today, our panel includes Kevin Richer, senior reporter and blogger with Idaho Education News, Melissa Davlin, host of Idaho Reports on Idaho Public Television, Scott McIntosh, opinion editor with the Idaho Statesman, Don Day, the founder and editor of BoiseDev.com, and Kelsey Mosley Morris with the Idaho Capital Sun. Hi, everybody.
Hello. Hi, Gemma.
Hello.
Happy Friday.
So we need to begin with, I think, what all of us have been mainly focused on, reporting on, and that is really just the horrible, horrible crime that happened in Moscow on Sunday. This is when four University of Idaho students were stabbed to death. And as I mentioned, I know that we've all been covering this as journalists, but I think it's fair to say that we've all been impacted as citizens. I mean, some of us went to school up on the Palouse, whether we went to the University of Idaho or Washington State. Some of us have friends who have children up there. Some of us have friends who live up there. Frankly, the ripple effects have been endless in this situation. And I know that there is a lot to get to in regards to this. So please, anyone, you know, come in and talk at any time. But Kevin, I would like to start with you. If you could just give us the background on what happened on Sunday.
Well, we saw the story unfolding Sunday with the reports of, it turned out, four university students killed in an off-campus house. Where we stand right now, as best as I've been able to piece together this morning, is this feels like an investigation that's still very much in its formative stages. What the Idaho State Police, which is now heading up the investigation, told the Spokesman Review overnight was that there is no suspect, there's no person of interest, there has been no weapon recovered, and I don't know if any of that has changed Friday morning, and I know people will listen at 8 o'clock on Friday night, so you know things could change between now and then as well. I was struck on Wednesday, and I know several of us were listening and watching the news conference, at how much the police department is still trying to piece together about this case. They're still trying to put together a timetable. They really have not said anything publicly about a motive. The mayor of Moscow talked about how it could be a crime of passion and walk that back. But the police also walked back a really important comment that they've made all week, that they believe that this was a targeted attack, that somebody in that house, one of the four victims or any combination of the four victims, were the target of a specific attack. So they have said that they don't believe that this is a larger threat to the community. But on Wednesday afternoon, the chief of police, James Fry, said, we can't guarantee that there is no threat. And we have somebody at large who has committed four horrible, horrible crimes. I think even though that was probably intuitive, since they didn't have a suspect in custody, that, you know, well, there is somebody at large, there is a threat. To hear the chief of police say that, I think, was really kind of a gut punch to a lot of folks in the community. And you're talking about, you know, not just the victims' families and loved ones who are foremost in our thoughts this week, but students, parents, staff, that whole Moscow community.
Oh, right. And Scott, jump in here, because you wrote an opinion piece in regards to kind of what is taking so long. And what I want our listeners to understand is that in no way does anyone want to impede this investigation, from the media to the families of the victims to the community of Moscow. No one wants to impede the investigation. But I think there is a difference in impeding the investigation and also giving a statement within the first 24 hours. Whereas, yes, the police did make a statement of there's no threat, you know, kind of go along your way. And all of that seemed to do, Scott, I think, was it caused more fear. It caused more questions. It caused more rumors. And yet when the news conference was held, as Kevin said, it was, you know, he was like, oh, well, let me take all of that back. It was frankly shocking.
Yeah. And I would even argue that the investigation may very well have been impeded by not releasing information. You know, you think back to Sunday afternoon where really the only information that was being released was that there are four students who were found unconscious. And then there was no indication that there was even a homicide or even a crime. And then somebody did say there was a homicide, but they didn't, you know, they didn't say all four were victims of a homicide. The State Board of Education president said that they were murdered. And like you said, the Moscow Police Department released information that there was no threat to the community, that it was a targeted attack. Well, again, if there's a targeted attack and the person doing the targeting has not been found or located or under arrest or dead, that means that they're still at large. So how can there not be any threat to the community? And so the rollout of the information was really just atrocious. And that Wednesday press conference, more than 75 hours mm-hmm. later, after the bodies were found, the information that they released, really, there's no reason that couldn't have been released on Sunday. And I think that they should have released that information, that there was a stabbing, four students were killed, and the suspect is at large. I don't know why that information could not have been released on Sunday. And I think that very well could have helped the investigation if they had released that and been honest with the public and told the public what was going on.
And this information gulf, Gemma, I mean, I think people do get tired of hearing reporters complain about not getting information. I get that. I mean, we're going to complain about that. We're going to push for information. It's what we do for a living. But this information vacuum is affecting people in this community. I've spent a lot of this week reaching out to parents who have legitimate concerns. You know, they reached out to us because they have concerns. It's a small sample, self-selecting sample of people with concerns. But I heard from a couple of those parents right after that news conference, really disappointed at what they didn't hear and what assurances they didn't get from the news conference. One emailed me and said, I am even more thankful that my daughter is home right now. So it's not just reporters, you know, whining about a lack of information. It is, you know, it's people with a direct stake, a community stake in this investigation, in this crime.
I think the victim's family is frustration about that too. So it wasn't just parents of students. Okay. It was the people actually affected, I think, who said that they've been frustrated by it.
There's a quote. Well,
and Kelsey, go ahead, Melissa.
It's actually Dawn. I think we're all
sorry,
Dawn.
Sorry.
I'll be very brief. There was a quote in the Spokesman Review from the aunt of one of the victims that said, "The police need social media that is not Facebook. They police a college town in 2022 and need to communicate with college kids. The lack of information, statements from left field from the mayor, and lack of outreach to the public to gain information for the case has made this even more painful for all of us to experience." That is the aunt of Maddie Mogan.
To tack onto that, it's not just... As you touched on earlier, it's not just the students, it's not just the families. There are people in this community who live there year round. And while a lot of families are relieved that they can bring their students home for Thanksgiving, most Moscow residents don't have that luxury, and they are still mm-hmm. waiting for answers, and they are still scared. That is what I have heard from every one of my friends who lives up there.
And I think getting back, Dawn, to that quote from Maddie's aunt, I found that to be, frankly, so telling, right? Because even when this news conference happened on Wednesday, I knew everything that the police told us. I knew that before they made those statements. That's because you have not just social media that is not Facebook, but you had the families who had to come out and make statements about their children in order to clear up any rumors about their children. You also have students who were talking to their parents who had interacted with these victims beforehand. I knew that there were two other roommates in that house, right? What the police did not clear up when they said there were two other roommates was, are they suspects? Are they people of interest? Are they victims too? And all that did was have more vitriol come online about these two roommates who very well could have also been victimized.
Well, and we had this, yes, and we had this moment at the end of the news conference where one of the reporters in the Spokane market was asking University of Idaho officials about a vandal alert in September that said that there was a person with a knife threatening, I believe, sorority students. And they were asking about this. And the guy's like, well, yeah, that did happen. And here's what happened. And the person there turned themselves into cops, turned themselves into Moscow police. And the reporter followed up and was like, well, are they related? And the University of Idaho rep said, well, you'll have to ask Moscow police. And this chief steps over and goes, okay, that's it. No more questions. And we're all like, wait, is this a major thing or not? And it seems like maybe not. But how do we know? Look, Kevin's right, and I am very guilty of getting up my high horse about open access to information, and it's usually on dumb things like renderings of, you know, buildings. But this is...
We all have a horse, Don. We all have a horse.
We do. This is fundamental, and people are being victimized that are innocent. People are being hurt that were already victimized. This isn't academic, and I'm always critical about communication stuff, but I'll tell you what, I was talking to the Boise State University spokesperson last night, and I was like, you know what, Brad Little, Lauren McLean, Marlene Tromp, Robert Simonson, any of the officials in the Treasure Valley would gladly send their best communications people up there to help. You just know that they would. And the city of Moscow and the Moscow police don't have PIOs, and that is not atypical in smaller towns. But there are resources that could be leveraged to help. And this is a time where PIOs are really, really helpful, and they're just absent. And so you have the mayor saying things that may or may not be true. You have a police chief who may be a good cop but isn't a good communicator. I'm not faulting them, but they need to find help because they're hurting people.
Especially when there's a vacuum of information. And Gemma, do we have time for just one more point?
Absolutely.
I think the message here too, this should be a warning or a cautionary tale for the city of Caldwell, the city of Nampa, the city of Pocatello, even the city of Boise that have colleges and universities in their town, to be prepared for something like this. And this is absolutely the wrong way to go about it. And if something like this happens, God forbid, somewhere else, just be prepared to handle it the proper way. Like Don said, you know, call in for help, get a PIO, you know, one person. And I still think Moscow should be doing the right thing. They should be having a press conference every day, updating the public on what's going on in this investigation. So I think it's a cautionary tale. God forbid if it ever happens elsewhere that other cities handle this much better.
End of the day, no parent should have to come out and make a statement about their murdered child because police aren't. And that is what continues to stick with me. With that said, before we take a break, I also wanted to let people know about another case that really was making headlines. And then because this case has just gotten so much traction, has made national, international news. That is the update on now 6-year-old Michael Vaughn. He's been missing since July of 2021. And he was had just turned 5 at the time of his disappearance in Fruitland. And as we know, Fruitland police have been out at a home near Michael's home excavating, and we're told that it will take about one more week. They had a very credible tip. There is now one woman in custody, and she was arraigned on a charge of not reporting a death. So we've also had that happening here in the Treasure Valley as well. So just, I think, so much happening this week that has been impacting these communities throughout our state. So just wanted people to know that we are also still, keeping an update on that as well. So Melissa, there is a man on death row here in Idaho, and he has been given a date for his execution. Can you fill us in on the background of this case and then where we are now with it?
Gerald Pizzuto was convicted for the 1985 murders of Berta and Delbert Herndon just outside of McCall. He has been on death row for several years now. And Last year, the Commission for Pardons and Parole actually recommended that his sentence be commuted to life in prison. He had been diagnosed with terminal cancer. Governor Brad Little declined to commute that sentence or change that sentence. And so now Pizzuto has been issued a death warrant from Idaho County, where he was convicted. But there's a catch, because the state, in their announcement at the Idaho Department of Correction, while announcing that that death warrant had been issued, they also said that they don't have the chemicals necessary to carry out that execution. This has been a sticking point in Idaho and in many other states across the country, trying to legally obtain these chemicals to execute people. There are the companies that make these for medical purposes don't want them used in executions a lot of the time. And so for the last two executions that Idaho carried out more than 10 years ago, the state had to obtain those chemicals in questionable ways. It's been the subject of lawsuits. So right now, the Idaho Department of Correction has suspended the implementation of basically the rule docket that that governs execution procedures. This is a 32-page document that covers everything from who the witnesses are to the timeline of what the execution is. The only part that they haven't suspended are the portions that ensure that he has due process. So It isn't clear yet what that means. It doesn't mean, or we don't know yet if it means that the tentative execution date for December 15th might be put off. We don't know. And I don't want to speculate, because IDOC is not answering questions. They're not issuing further comment at this time because of ongoing litigation. But it is safe to say that there are a lot of questions surrounding how the state intends to carry out this execution.
And Kelsey, let's talk about an article that you recently wrote. I do know that you've been covering all of there are numerous lawsuits regarding abortion here in Idaho that you've been following. But you wrote a really interesting article about the history of abortion here in our state and maybe how the Supreme Court might rule on that. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I did a deep dive into some of the newspapers of old, which was really fascinating, I'll tell you. I came across some interesting stuff. But it's worth noting that Idaho passed its first abortion law in 1864 in the territorial session, the first territorial session they had in Lewiston, which was the original capital, before Idaho was even a state. And that was actually at a time when a lot of different states were passing abortion laws. And they used kind of the same exact language to write those up, including Montana and Nevada. And they didn't include exceptions for rape and incest like our current law does, but they included an exception for the life of the mother. And it's the most important thing to know out of that whole piece is that between 1864 and 1973, when Roe was originally decided, only six people were actually prosecuted under that law. And that's for several different reasons. One is that a lot of times it was difficult to prove that an abortion had even happened. And so prosecutors weren't really that interested in going after people if they weren't going to even be able to prove it. Two was that there was still a lot of popular tolerance back then for abortion as a personal matter to be decided between a family. And it wasn't really a matter for the courts. And so they had a hard time getting juries to decide that that was something worth prosecuting. And they also, the people who were prosecuted, I think three of them were when the woman had died in the process or after getting the procedure. And one of those was a doctor who served 7 years, I think, in the penitentiary, or three of the 7 years he was sentenced to. And so the Supreme Court, he appealed his ruling to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court at that time actually made some comments about how they felt about abortion, and they talked about it being one of the worst things you could do under the law, and how they thought even if the woman did survive, she should be prosecuted under the law too. I think I talked to a constitutional law professor up at U of I who talked about how, you know, there is a long legislative history of Idaho saying that we don't approve of abortion and we think it should have some criminal penalties attached to it. And so the Supreme Court, now that we have our justices now, are in a situation where they're having to look at that legislative history and decide if that's more important than interpreting the Constitution's right to privacy as one that extends to abortion. And so they've kind of, now that Roe has been struck down, they're in this kind of quandary where they're going to have to make a decision one way or the other. And it just comes down to which one they think is more salient, I guess.
Mm-hmm. And Kelsey, on that point, any updates as to where the Supreme Court is in regards to making a decision on any of these?
I checked last week, I think, with the PIO of the courts, and he did not have any indication of when that's coming. I kind of guessed on my own assumptions that they were waiting until after the election to avoid any kind of influence on that. And so I'm expecting it in the next few weeks, I would think. But I don't know at this point.
Okay. So Dawn, normally we wouldn't be talking about a parking lot being for sale, and that really wouldn't make any news headlines. But this might be one that we want to pay attention to, and tell us why.
Yeah, so I'm on the list for the state of Idaho's RFPs for property, and they're usually dreadfully boring. And this one looked like it was going to be dreadfully boring. I went, oh, cool, a parking lot. And then I just Google mapped it really quick and I was like, oh, it's that parking lot. So the YMCA, the Capital City Development Corporation, and several private developers have come together, to redevelop about 2.5 blocks of downtown Boise in the area of the Y. They would tear down the existing YMCA and some other buildings, build a 20-story building with housing and parking, build a new building for the YMCA, and then this building that they call a nonprofit jewel box in the area. But what's interesting as they've gone through this process is it's called Block 68, and that is named for the block number in the original Boise City plat. And they control all of Block 68 except for this one little parcel, and that's the one little parcel that's now for sale. The state, by state law, has to basically offer this to the highest bidder. You can imagine that the development group would love to have that piece of property. They can make their 20-story building a little bigger and do some other things. But anybody could bid. If you've got the most money and you want to have this piece of property, you can have it. You could keep it a parking lot. You could build your own building, or which has happened before in some of these deals, you could just play spoiler. And so we'll see what happens here, but it is kind of an interesting little case of a parking lot at the corner of 16th and Jefferson in downtown Boise. And we'll see where this goes as that project develops.
Okay, so I'm trying to visualize that 16th.
It's hard to visualize. It's basically,
yeah,
it's very close to the YMCA. There's really not any great landmarks right there. It's behind the old Idaho Sporting Goods building and next to an ugly green office building. I mean, it's really not very, you know.
Okay, right there. I do think that's going to be interesting, though, to watch, Dawn, because the Y has been talking about really needing to expand their facilities for years now. And in particular, I think with the influx of so many people moving in, you know, they're bursting at the seams, frankly.
I mean, they've been bursting at the seams since they redid that building in the 90s. It's just, it's been a problem for decades, and it's a popular spot to go, especially for people in the North End and the East End and who live downtown. It's kind of a good facility. I remember, as I think most people who grew up here did, going to the YMCA pool, and it's just dated. It definitely is something that I think that it is going to be replaced. Now, the trick here, and this isn't part of the parking lot, but they have to get this all done basically in the next 3.5 years because of the way that Idaho's urban renewal law works. It all has to be done by the time the urban renewal district terminates in the fall of 2026. And you're like, well, it's 2022. That's a long time. But you think about the fact that all the planning has to get done. All the approvals have to happen. They have to get it financed. And then they have to get built on a fairly tight timeline. And there's not a lot of wiggle room. 4 years isn't a lot of time, especially for a project on this scale. So they're moving as quick as they can there.
Yeah. So, Scott, before we go take a break, some big news for the Boys and Girls Club, at least in CUNA, correct?
Yeah, the Boys and Girls Clubs of Ada County announced that CS Beef Packers has donated $4 million toward the construction of a Boys and Girls Club clubhouse in CUNA, which is a really big deal. CS Beef Packers has a beef processing plant near CUNA, kind of on the outskirts of town. And so now the Boys and Girls Clubs of Ada County has about $6 million toward a $10 million project. This is going to be a 25,000 square foot facility that'll serve 200 to 250 kids. And I know about this project because it's been a long time in the making. It's been at least 16 years. Wow. It was one of the first stories I ever wrote when I moved to Idaho. And it is on the front page of the very first issue of the CUNA Melba News that I wrote, that I, as owner of the CUNA Melba News in 2006, basically saying that a new Boys and Girls Club may be coming to CUNA. And over the past 16 years, it's been fits and starts. Of course, we had the Great Recession, which kind of scuttled it. An ACHD drainage easement scuttled it. It seems like finally they are getting some momentum, and this $4 million donation from CS Beef Packers will go a long way toward maybe finally getting a Boys and Girls Club in CUNA. Some good news.
So Kevin, what do we know right now about soon to be Superintendent of Public Instruction, Debbie Critchfield's transition into her new role?
Well, I think she's putting together a team pretty quickly. She moved right after the election. I mean, 2 days after the election, she announced two major hires. She hired Greg Wilson, who had been Governor Brad Little's education advisor through most of Little's first term. Wilson is going to serve as Critchfield's chief of staff. Ryan Cantrell, who's less known to many Idahoans, he's a former school superintendent. He's worked for the Idaho Digital Learning Academy, which is the state's online learning portal. He's going to be a deputy state superintendent. These are two fairly well-known folks in education circles, though. And she, like I say, she's moving quickly. She put together a transition team. She announced that earlier this week because she's taking over a large department. I mean, the Department of Education has 130 positions, and she's not going to replace all 130 people, but she's going to have a chance to put a stamp on that department in some key positions, and she's already doing that.
And Melissa, another transition is happening, this at the Attorney General's office. What do we know so far about this transition?
Incoming Attorney General Raul Labrador also has announced two key hires. So yesterday he announced that he has hired David Dewhurst, who is the current Montana Solicitor General. He is going to be the chief deputy for Attorney General-elect Labrador, which is a key position. It's a very forward-facing position. And the other hire that he announced was Theo Wold as the incoming Solicitor General. This is a position that Idaho used to have in its Attorney General's office, hasn't had in quite some time. I'm not sure if current Attorney General Wasden has ever had a Solicitor General. Wold was active in Labrador's campaign, and he was the acting assistant attorney general in the Office of Legal Policy at the Department of Justice. And he was deputy assistant to the president for domestic policy under President Donald Trump, according to Labrador's press release. And so again, these are two kind of insider baseball positions, but they're big gets mm-hmm. for the incoming attorney general. And I'm sure that he'll have more announcements in the coming month.
But neither of these attorneys are from Idaho, correct? So he's pulling from outside of the state.
You know, Theodore Wold has been a resident of Boise for a while now, even though he did work in D.C. And Dewhurst, you know, as I mentioned, is the current Solicitor General for Montana. Labrador, in his campaign, had said that he wanted to pull talent for the Idaho Attorney General's office. And he had been talking to lawyers from around the country who were interested in coming to Idaho and were interested in working for the Attorney General's office. So this lines up with what he campaigned on.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So Dawn, an update to the Albertsons-Kroger merger. Man, there's been drama around this merger that may or may not happen, I guess.
Yeah, I feel like I'm writing a soap opera lately. As folks probably know by now, Albertsons companies agreed to be acquired by Kroger last month in a fairly significant deal. What was somewhat novel about this is at the time of the merger, the acquisition, Albertsons and Kroger said that they would pay a $4 billion dividend to shareholders, but they would do that quickly in November, this month. They call it a merger, but it's an acquisition. But it's an acquisition. The acquisition isn't supposed to be complete until early 2024, pending regulatory review. And so we actually did an early story on this. Nobody had really picked up on it. And I was like, this is very strange. I don't understand this. And so we did a story a couple of weeks ago. And then a few days later, two different groups of attorneys general came out and said, hey, whoa, what you doing with that dividend payment there? And the first one included Idaho Attorney General Lawrence Wasdin. They wrote a letter to Albertson saying, we would respectfully ask you not to do this dividend payment. We don't think it's the right thing to do, essentially. And the DC Attorney General who led that group said that they thought that it might be an attempt to hobble the company to make the case later in court that it was a failing company and without the acquisition, it would fail. There's been no evidence of that. That's just an allegation by the DC Attorney General. So that group of attorneys general sued. And then separately, the Attorney General in Washington State sued. The DC group didn't get a lot of traction. Idaho didn't join on to that action. They decided not to sue. But the Washington Attorney General got a temporary restraining order from a judge at the King County Superior Court that stopped the dividend payment. It delayed it first for a few days. It then pushed it back to a hearing that was supposed to start on Wednesday. The court then said, yeah, you know what? We're not going to do this yet. We're going to push it back till December. And so this is a lot of limbo. Albertson's not happy. They've issued several statements saying that they disagree with Washington Attorney General and say that what they're doing is legal and proper, that it was approved by their board of directors. The key here is that Albertson's is what's called a control company with the majority of its stock owned by a group of investors that put money in 2006 and still control the company. It's publicly traded, so you can buy shares in it. But the majority of the stock is actually owned by a group led by Cerberus Capital Management. That group is wanting to monetize that investment that they've been holding on to for a very long time. And this is a way to get cash out to those shareholders very quickly. It's unclear what's going to happen next, what the King County Superior Court will do. And there are other things swirling. We have the Federal Trade Commission that's likely going to have a say on this. And we have a group of strange bedfellows, bipartisan senators, including Bernie Sanders, Republican Mike Lee of Utah, Democrat Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota, and others who intend to hold hearings in the Judiciary Committee because they believe that this acquisition is monopolistic. So we have a lot of story to be written here. What happens for Albertsons is very much an open question.
Oh, 100%. It's going to be interesting to see if this actually ends up happening come 2024.
Yes.
Scott, tell us about this opinion piece that you recently wrote about energy efficiency in Idaho. This may not be something that most people may follow, but definitely some reasons to be paying attention.
Yeah, for sure. And I know Margaret Carmel from Boise Dev has done a lot of really great reporting on this. And I kind of just swooped in at the last minute. The Idaho Building Code Board, there is such a thing as the Idaho Building Code Board. They met on Tuesday to discuss this proposal by the Department of Occupational and Professional Licensing, an executive branch agency. They were proposing changes to the 2018 International Energy Conservation Code, which you know, just it sets minimum standards for energy efficiency for walls and floors and heating, ventilation, air conditioning, electrical, insulation, plumbing, that kind of a thing. And really, a lot of people felt that this was just gutting the energy efficiency codes. Mind you, this is the 2018 code. This isn't even the current code. I think it was 149, something like 149 people wrote letters on this, and 141 of those letters were against it. You had the city of Boise, you had the city of Nampa, you had some individual architects, you had Idaho Power, all opposed to it for various reasons, but basically just saying that we need a minimum standard here for energy efficiency. Idaho Power obviously really is gonna desperately need energy efficiency to meet the demands of all the new people that are moving into Idaho. And conservation is one of those pieces that's going to be needed. So like I said, the Building Code Board met on Tuesday. They met for 5 hours kind of went around and around and eventually decided to table the discussion or table the decision that they weren't going to, they basically left it alone. They're keeping the 2018 standards for now. I suspect this is going to come back. I think they've got to meet in February where they're going to discuss the 2021 codes. And then also I suspect that we might see something in the legislature about this. So for now, we've still got the energy efficiency codes, but who knows what's going to happen next year.
So Kevin, get us updated on K through 12 enrollment here in Idaho. What's going on with that?
Well, the new numbers came out this week, and there's an increase, but it's not a very large increase. Basically, enrollment across the state increased by just under 1,000 students. And you go back a couple of years, we were seeing enrollment increases both before and after the pandemic, statewide in the 5,000 student range. So it definitely feels like demographically things are changing a little bit. There just aren't as many school-age kids in the pipeline right now.
Okay. And do they have any reason to think that, Kevin? I mean, does it go back to the pandemic? Because I do know that, I believe you've done reporting on this in the past where, I mean, I don't want to use the word like kids just disappeared, but a lot of kids just dropped out from enrollment and we haven't been able to figure out where they re-enrolled or if they enrolled anywhere.
Kids did disappear. They did come back, at least in terms of the enrollment numbers that we saw post-pandemic. But I think demographics are changing. I think long-term, we're going to see maybe birth rates not as high as we've seen in the past. And that maybe is part of what we're seeing right now. And interesting, because these enrollment numbers, very small increase in West Ada, which has seen a lot of growth for years and years and years. And Boise saw another year of enrollment decline to where Boise's enrollment now is at its lowest point since 1990. And it's declined now for several years in a row.
But, you know, Kevin, I think this also goes back to the fact that housing, the cost of buying a home in Boise has gone up exponentially over the last few years, that if you are a family with young children, you can probably better afford to live in the West Ada School District than you can in the Boise School District. So then there's this idea of like, okay, then how does that then impact the Boise schools? Because if you don't have enough students, do you eventually close a school? Who knows?
Exactly. Housing costs, definitely a factor. And it's not just increases in West Ada. One of the fastest growing districts in the state is the Valley View District, which is out near Nampa Caldwell. So yes, I think definitely you have families who are leaving the Boise School District because they have to, because, you know, in order to afford a house, they have to.
Yeah.
West.
Yeah. So Don, I can't believe this, but more apartments are coming to downtown Boise.
Yeah. And you said that, I was like, wait, which apartment project?
Which one?
Pitch. Yeah. So there's I'll just talk generally here. There are in the kind of the west part of downtown, in the area where there used to be car dealerships, the area, where, Channel 2 is located, kind of that general western downtown. There are more than 1,000 apartment projects, apartment units.
Like,
it feels like there's 1,000.
That's a lot. Yeah.
So there are about 1,000 units that are in some phase of either approval or development. And it would really remake this area. Right now, there's a large empty, for years under construction, potential St. Luke's Hospital facility there. And not a lot else. You've got Rudy the Rooster, and you've got a couple of motels. If this all comes to be, you're going to really see a very big change in that part of downtown for people to live. A lot of these apartment complexes have ground floor retail space. There's mm-hmm. a large project that's actually underway at kind of Whitewater Park Boulevard there that is called the Avens, that would have some high-end features for residents. So it could be an area of downtown that right now you walk around down there and you don't see other people, frankly, that could soon be very busy with lots of different types of workers finding places to live downtown.
Well, you don't necessarily see people walking around down in that area, Don, but I mean,
they're driving.
So much building going on. I mean, everywhere. All right. So I want to end just for my own personal purposes, because my children won't stop asking, Don, when does Topgolf open? Do we know?
Your children and everybody else's children. Topgolf is set to, I understand, soft open next week. They've been a little cagey on that. They made no announcements, but their sales director told me that they were shooting for Thanksgiving week. They are going to start taking actual reservations starting December 5th. If you would like to go, stand in a booth and shoot golf balls over a large green driving range and drink a beer and watch some ESPN, you can soon do that.
Okay, so here's my question before we wrap up. Are there golf balls that are going to hit on the freeway? I cannot be the only person who has wondered that.
I am not the strongest person in the world, as anybody who has seen me can attest. I'm a journalist. I don't think anybody is strong enough. Those nets
okay.
are really high. Those nets are like 150 feet high. I imagine that there will be some jokers who are drunk who think that they could try and shoot balls over the nets into the freeway. Anything is possible, but I don't think that's going to come to pass.
Okay. I figured they have a tried and true, track record on this.
Incredible Hulk.
Yeah, exactly.
Kevin Richard, one of those guys.
Yeah. Well, we'll know the culprit, right?
Don't look at me. I'm a mini golf guy.
Well, I want to thank all of you for being here today and taking the time to get us updated on everything that went on this week. So many thanks to Kevin Richard, senior reporter and blogger with Idaho Education News, Melissa Davlin, host of Idaho Reports on Idaho Public Television, Scott McIntosh, opinion editor with the Idaho Statesman, Don Day, the founder and editor of BoiseDev.com, and Kelsey Mosley Morris, who joined us for the first part of the show with the Idaho Capital Sun. Do make sure that you check out everyone's reporting. Really, just some stellar journalists here in our area. For more details on the stories that we talked about today, of course, you can find more links at our website, BoiseStatePublicRadio.org. You can also go to all of their websites. I want to thank all of you for joining us today. Our senior producer is Samantha Wright. Our assistant producer is Hannah Gardowski. Our executive producers, Paul Stribling and Tom Michael. Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
Experiencing the news each day can feel like a journey. With Up First from NPR, it doesn't have to be. Welcome to 15 easy minutes of breaking news, clarity on international and national affairs, all handed over not from some floating voice in the sky, from us, Layla, A, Steve, and me, Rachel. Start your day informed. Subscribe to Up First wherever you get your podcasts.